Hello again. Following is my editorial commentary on the problems and pitfalls of randomized trials of new procedures. The use of randomized trials was introduced 60 years ago to assess the effectiveness of streptomycin for the treatment of tuberculosis. Though neither double-blinded nor placebo-controlled, that trial introduced a new era in the assessment of therapeutic innovations. Today, new drugs cannot gain clinical acceptance or regulatory approval without randomized trials. Within the medical community, an insistence on the stringent criterion of randomized studies has been extended de facto to include new operations, procedures, and techniques, all of which must now be validated by such studies before they can gain wide acceptance. Though the FDA does not yet license operations per se, it does approve devices, which affects many new procedures that employ them. When coronary bypass surgery was first introduced, Hyatt suggested in the New England Journal of Medicine that randomized trials should precede widespread dissemination, as is done to a considerable extent for drugs. Spodek went further, vehemently suggesting that such studies be performed, quote, from the very first clinical trial of all new operations, end quote, and should precede widespread use, quote, not only of surgical procedures, but of costly procedures of all kinds. End quote. The subject requires less heated debate. Such opinions reveal a failure to understand the many differences between randomized trials of new drugs and trials of new procedures. Randomized trials that compare the effectiveness of drugs or combinations of drugs are comparing apples with apples. Those that compare medical treatment with surgical or procedural therapy are comparing apples with oranges and are subject to unavoidable misinterpretation. Although I first wrote about this topic many years ago, non-surgical interventions are so common that this discussion is more pertinent than ever. There are multiple differences between drugs and procedures. Drugs have an unchanging composition, and as drug usage increases, additional side effects and complications become apparent. When used in a trial, a drug's effectiveness is unrelated to the physician's skill. Not only are results generally consistent among collaborating institutions, but they are also applicable to non-participating institutions. Finally, a placebo is usually available, and crossovers between treatment groups are therefore exceptional. In contrast, new procedures are introduced while they are still imperfect. The indications are uncertain and the risks are high. As the procedure becomes more widespread, refinements occur and the risks decline, often dramatically. In early trials, results vary considerably in the hands of different operators. Placebos are obviously not available for any invasive procedure, and crossovers from medical to procedural treatment groups are commonplace. Further, it is commonly assumed that randomization eliminates bias, though this is mostly true for trials that compare different drug regimens. When new procedures are compared with medical therapy, some types of bias cannot be avoided. First is the possibility of pre-selection bias, which can occur before patients are even referred to the study. When two different drug protocols or two surgical protocols are being compared with each other, referring physicians rarely have reason to prefer one to the other, and many are willing to accept randomization of all of their patients. In contrast, when a new procedure, and I think here of coronary bypass in its early years as a good example, when a new procedure is being evaluated, physicians are more likely to either want it or to distrust it for their high-risk patients, and they refer such patients for the therapy they prefer. The result is a diversion of such patients away from randomizations, while the lower risk patients about whom physicians feel less strongly are randomized. We commonly observe that patients in both limbs of randomized trials fare better than historical controls. This result is generally attributed to both the stringent selection criteria that define the cohort in the trial and the more attentive, more standardized, and thus generally more effective therapy the trial patients receive. Undiscussed, however, is the important influence of referral bias, which yields a low-risk cohort. This issue is one of concern because in low-risk patients, it is difficult to prove that a new therapy is more effective. An example of this phenomenon occurred during early efforts to assess the efficacy of coronary artery bypass. I'm personally familiar with this experience because in the 1970s, a randomized trial of coronary artery bypass for stable angina was initiated at the Oregon Health Sciences University. I had just joined the faculty after completing my cardiac surgery training there. It was striking to observe the relentless diversion of referrals for coronary bypass away from the university and to private surgical teams, who readily accommodated the referring physician's growing preference for the new option of surgical therapy. The trial terminated with much smaller patient subgroups than originally planned, and it was eventually reported with statistically inconclusive results. A second cause of unintended bias is the fact that even participating investigators have human instincts and subtle biases that can influence the selection or exclusion of patients for randomization. In the U.S. Veterans Administration study of coronary bypass surgery, patients could be excluded because of undefined and subjective criteria, such as, quote, poor left ventricular function, end quote. Such vague definitions led to a tendency at many participating hospitals to include only the most stable and willing patients. A third source of bias is non-adherence to the assigned therapy, or crossing over. In drug studies, crossovers are usually infrequent, they can occur in both directions, and they have little effect on the statistical analyses. In contrast, when an operation or procedure is being studied, crossovers can occur only in one direction, from medical to procedural therapy. If they occur frequently and freely, the medical group eventually comes to be composed only of patients in whom medical therapy is successful. Even the most elaborate statistical manipulations cannot overcome some of the confounding statistical effects of large numbers of such crossovers. This was a particular issue in early studies that compared coronary bypass with medical therapy, since patients with persistent symptoms opted overwhelmingly for bypass surgery and were no longer available to experience complications such as death or MI on late follow-up of the medical group. This latter criticism has usually been met with the argument that patients who do well after crossing over to surgery after a period of medical therapy demonstrate that there's no harm in reserving surgical therapy for patients who fail a trial of initial medical therapy. This conclusion is valid, but the favorable experience with such crossovers must not then be used to compare the results of initial surgical with initial medical therapy. Unfortunately, it's unusual for any later citation of the results of such trials to mention the incidence and problem of crossovers. Well, that brings us to the question of when should randomized trials of procedures be done. Let's get back to Spodek's suggestion mentioned earlier that randomized studies should be performed from the very first clinical trial of, quote, costly procedures of all kinds, end quote. Accompanying this well-intentioned, if somewhat naive, proposal was the more fevered suggestion that editors of scientific journals should reject reports of non-randomized trials. Both of these ideas fail to acknowledge that the rapid evolution of surgical and other procedural techniques usually invalidates early trials. The U.S. Veterans Administration study of coronary bypass surgery began in the early 1970s, and when results were finally reported, it was intensely criticized for high mortality and poor graft patency rates in comparison with contemporary outcomes at that time. Indeed, progress was so dramatic and the decline in morbidity and mortality so precipitous that initial entries from 1970 to 1972 were simply discarded. Ultimately, the VA study had little impact on the practice of coronary surgery as it was outdated on arrival. In a more recent example, randomized trials of intracoronary stents had no sooner been reported than the results were superseded by dramatic changes in anticoagulant therapy. The story is being repeated yet again with drug-eluting stents, for which antiplatelet regimens continue to evolve, and clinical studies of their results lose impact soon after publication. Another disadvantage of early trials of operations and procedures is their tendency to stifle technical progress, which ordinarily comes from many investigators. By their nature, trials are confined to a restricted list of institutions, which limits innovation by others. On the other hand, if a randomized trial is delayed until a procedure is, quote, mature, and good results are the norm, it will be difficult or impossible to randomize a broad spectrum of patients. In the coronary artery surgery study, begun in the United States after coronary bypass was well established, some institutions did not randomize any patients and participated only in the registry. The incentive to participate in early randomized trials is provided by grants that are often vital to the participating institutions. Even when a proposed trial is premature, a decision not to participate in a multi-institutional study, or perish the thought to abandon an ongoing trial that is becoming obsolete and pointless, is a form of bureaucratic and academic self-mutilation. Large collaborative studies generate their own central bureaucracy and peripheral constituency, with many clinicians, statisticians, data coordinators, etc., being supported by grant funds. When the U.S. Veterans Administration proposed a randomized study of the Bjork-Shiley mechanical heart valve versus the Hancock porcine valve in 1976, I declined to participate. I might mention that I was then in Milwaukee, where the Zablocki Veterans Administration Hospital was part of the academic program at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where I was the chairman of cardiac surgery. The study was doomed to premature obsolescence and irrelevance because of the predictably rapid development of prosthetic heart valves. Patients were enrolled between 1977 and 1982, and the study plodded stubbornly onward for many years at great public expense until late results were reported in 1993. By then, no models of the Bjork-Shiley valve were even sold in the United States, and the standard Hancock model initially used in the study had long since been supplanted by hydraulically superior models. I conclude that the most useful randomized studies of procedures are those that compare one with another, or those that assess a specific refinement in an established procedure or with an established device, such as the use of different anticoagulation regimens for coronary stents. Randomized trials that compare new procedures with established ones should guard against pre-randomization bias and must allocate patients to treatment groups based on objective or quantitative criteria, not on subjective clinical judgment. Risk, length of follow-up, and sample size must be used to calculate the statistical power of the study so that a significant difference between treatments does not remain undetected, the so-called type 2 statistical error. There should already be sufficient experience with the new procedure so that complication rates have stabilized and so that participating operators are equally comfortable with all procedures being studied. Even with the above stipulations, however, randomized trials that compare medical with procedural therapy pose many additional problems, and few such studies have had a major impact on clinical practice. And finally, randomized trials look at defined and usually low-risk cohorts that rarely reflect the full spectrum of patients seen in clinical practice. The results of such trials cannot be expanded to the general population. Non-randomized retrospective studies and the prospective registries can provide clinically useful information that is complementary to randomized trials. The introduction of propensity scoring to derive comparable groups from large registries and meta-analysis of multiple clinical series can substitute for the sometimes slavish use of randomized studies, even when they are unlikely to be helpful. Though sophisticated statistical manipulation is needed to compare outcomes in registry patients, the results can be a useful guide to managing the broad spectrum of patients in a typical clinician's practice. Large registries with a much broader spectrum of patients from the general population can therefore be vital companions to randomized clinical trials.